and welcome to Under Common Taste. This is a podcast where we create and discuss homebrew content for tabletop RPGs.
Surfing, wading, and swimming, not advised. Shark area, strong undertow currents, and sneaker waves. Enter at your own risk.
I'm Ian Woodworth. I'm joined by my co-host James Daly, and today we are continuing our biome series. Is it a series?
A series or arc? Either way, but yes, definitely a series.
It will be a series once we...
Yes.
I don't think two a series makes, but we're getting there.
Yes.
We're getting there.
There are plans, yes. Grand schemes, wheels within wheels, plots within plots.
We have lots of schemes. Our problem is executing our schemes.
Yeah, this is true. I also need to watch the second Dune movie as soon as I get a chance to, because...
I still haven't gotten a chance to watch the first one.
I do enjoy the first one, and I don't think this is spoilers. If you're a fan of the books, you might miss it like I did. And I get why they do it, but in the movies, at least in the first half of the movies, they have removed all mention of the Mentats. And this does make me sad. But that is a personal rant that is not D&D related.
However, having read the first six books, I think that's the ones that people say, okay, once you finish book six, you can stop.
You went six in? I'm impressed.
I did. I went six in.
I went like two in and then caught the cliff notes because it just got weird.
I will agree that it did get weird.
Yes.
And at times not in a good way.
Yes.
But having read the books before watching the new movie, I think that casting Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho was an inspired choice without having actually seen Jason Momoa's performance.
Fair.
Because the descriptions that they give of Duncan Idaho, I can absolutely see Jason Momoa in my mind's eye as I'm going through.
I totally get that. For whatever reason, I watched something for the longest time. I thought, well, you know what? We can discuss this when we do the desert biome. Let us pull back into the oceans and the coastline. For once, I am the guiding voice of reason pulling us back on topic.
Things that Arrakis doesn't have.
Yes.
Yet.
Yet. Exactly.
Spoilers for like book four.
Yes.
Anyway. So yeah, we are going to be talking about the coastal biome today. And whenever I started working on building an outline to try and keep myself on track a little bit, not that it's done us very good so far, but when I was making my outline, it occurred to me just how broad a definition coastal is.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I got your notes. You know, I was very much picturing seacoast, coastal as the meeting of land versus ocean. Even within North America, that does range into several different things, which we can talk about. But yeah, I very much had ocean coast in mind.
Yeah, and that is the most common definition. But I would also argue that major rivers, lakes, those are also coastlines. Freshwater coastal is still coastal.
I mean, honestly, an inland sea would be coastal as well.
Absolutely.
Like the Black Sea or something like that. Or, you know, even the Great Lakes, again, in North America. Yeah, those have a pronounced coast. And I believe you are correct, and they should not be ignored.
Right. And the nature of the water on that coastline greatly influences the sort of biome that you have, because you get much different collection of flora and fauna on a coastline with salt water compared to a coastline with fresh water. And then also you get a different collection of stuff in those estuary areas, in those areas where fresh water is emptying into salt water, where the rivers are emptying into the ocean, where you have that brackish mixing that varies with the tides.
Yeah, that, again, there's a lot of diversity that is possible.
So yes, this is going to be probably a little more of an overview type episode as opposed to really digging in, because we could really do this as two separate episodes, one doing saltwater, one doing freshwater, because they are very different from one another.
Right. And again, so what we're going to do here is we're going to kind of describe the biome, what you could expect to find. And again, with this series, we kind of want to build up our random encounter tables for your players. Now, I think with coastal, this does tie in really well with our urban that we tackled last time before our awesome interview we had 2 weeks ago. But going in with the urban, generally the coastal and urban butt up really close against each other, because these coastal, especially port areas, are going to be bustling hives of people dwelling in industry and residence and commerce. And yes, you will have large stretches that are not. And again, it is wilderness and wildness, but it would not be unexpected at all to come across, you know, a port town, a village, or just a full-fledged capital city. You could span any of those options.
Yeah, that is a very important point. Coastal areas have been sites for human settlement for millennia. They are very desirable locations because whenever you have a settlement in a coastal location, particularly in a location where you have either just a river or where you have a river emptying into an ocean, you end up having the combination of reliable sources of fresh water, reliable sources of food, and usually pretty reliable and fertile land that can be cultivated.
Right. And if you have any form of seafaring or ocean going society at all, now you also have quick and rapid transit as well.
Yes, because whenever it comes to moving people and stuff, boats are just so much more efficient than wagons.
Generally, yeah, a lot less bumps. Things move a lot faster. Another
buoyancy.
Buoyancy is a thing, yes.
There's a reason why humans have been cutting canals for hundreds and close to thousands of years.
Well, that and irrigation, but yes.
Yeah, both.
But another fun thing that we can encounter within a fantasy world like D&D or any kind of tabletop gaming that we don't see as much in real world is a lot of the monsters and creatures that we're going to deal with are otherwise intelligent as well, you know, either having close to and often superior to human intelligence. And people within D&D, within civilizations, within things, take a very colonial model, which is fortunate, unfortunate, both for the game. But a lot of these things kind of get pushed out. And so, again, if you want to build some sort of territorial conflict within a different race or a collective of intelligent creatures, you know, this was our area. And, you know, these elves, these half elves, these humans, these half orcs all come in and they set up the city and they put up walls and they pushed us all out. But that was our area. We were there first. We want it back. Makes for a very quick and easy engagement for a story hook.
Right. And we've touched on some things like this in past episodes. Another example that you could have, especially if you're talking about a settlement that is being built on an ocean coast, is a conflict that will arise between the terrestrial settlers, the humanoids living in the city, and say, Tritons or merfolk that are living out in the sea, just, you know, in this bay that butts up against this city.
Yeah, those were our tide pools, you know, and then all of a sudden you start like walling stuff off and now the tides can't wash in correctly, or, you know, your ships are knocking into our stuff. And yeah, I mean, this very easily can lead rise to conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you know, overfishing, you know, catching merfolk in your nets, things of that nature. Whenever we're talking about the Kelpies in our episode where we were talking about European cryptids, the Kelpies in D&D were actually hunted almost to extinction because of an oil that they secrete. And it was actually the sea elves in this one cove that ended up basically cultivating Kelpies in order to bring them back from the brink of extinction.
So, yeah, and this is one bad aspect. And again, this is an unfortunate aspect that we can pull in. Another kind of better aspect you can see in these coastal towns is the types of races you're going to see. You're going to get, generally, unless you're making an isolationist city or region, you are going to see a lot more diversity. Because again, if it is a port, it is going to be a hub of transport. It is going to be a hub of trade, be it economic or political or whatever. So you'll likely see a lot more of like your half elves or your half orcs or, you know, your half whatevers, or maybe something that doesn't necessarily belong on your continent. Maybe you'll have turtles come in or the Arakoa. You know, this would explain why these far-flung and very strange and alien-looking creatures are in your region or area, because here's a trade point.
And if you look at some of the major cities that exist in D&D lore, Waterdeep is a port city.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chult is a port city. The city is called Chult, right? I know it's not, it's not just the island.
No, the island is Chult. The main port is Port Ner'zaru.
Okay.
Baldur's Gate itself has its own docks. It is also a port city. I believe it's more of an inline river, if I remember correctly. It might be connected to... I know it's on the Sword Coast, so it might be straight to the sea. But again, it does have a whole port and docks district as well.
Right. And most of the major cities that you see in any given D&D adaptation, in most campaigns, they will have a port city.
Absolutely.
You know, in Critical Role, Iman had its own ports. Whitestone had its own ports. I can't remember the name of the town that they're starting in campaign three. It's in the middle of the jungle, but it has airship ports, which is an interesting take on it. So it's not ships, it's airships, which changes that dynamic a bit.
But it's still there.
It's still there, yeah.
Multicultural hub, which makes things very exciting.
Yeah. And so some other aspects that you will see whenever you're dealing with these major coastal towns, in addition to the diversity of species that you're going to have, diversity of races, it's going to be placed in a strategic location to make it a desirable stop for trade. It's not going to be out of the way.
Yeah.
It's going to have something that people want. It's going to have a commodity. And it might just be that this is a location that is halfway between point A and point B, that is just a very convenient place to stop and reprovision. You know, a place that is just a town that has fresh water and lots of food. That could be it. It could just be a simple stopover, but it's got to have something that makes the ships want to stop there.
Yeah. Again, it could also just be a defensible point as well, or, you know, just a natural peninsula or a gulf or a bay, a natural harbor or a cove. But when it comes to getting these things on a table, and if we are trying to roll up a random encounter for your party, at this point, as a DM, if you were in this area, I would probably roll just, you know, a D6 or D20, odd or even, and pick one for falling within an urban environment for this, in which case I would reference back to our urban episode, you know, our urban encounter episode that we had a couple weeks ago. Or if you want to deal with wilderness, which I think we're probably going to focus more on with this one.
I agree, because we did cover urban environments fairly recently, like two episodes ago. And so there are some flavor things that you can add to make it distinctly coastal, but by and large, it's going to function like any other urban setting.
Yeah, so with that, we're going to go ahead, we're going to break down kind of what the coastal wilderness is going to look like. And much like we did with our urban environments, we're going to sit down, and I believe last time we broke down with a D12, or was it a D20?
It was a D12.
D12, so we're going to break down a D12 so we can kind of quickly generate a table of some possible encounters. Again, it's going to be some wilderness encounters, it's going to be wild animals, it's going to be creatures. Again, not every random encounter has to be a fight to the death for your party. Sometimes it can be a boon, or hey, you stumbled across the happy. Here's a sudden treasure you find. Here is, you know, the random woodcutter who tells the party a fun story and they get a night's respite. Maybe they do come across some bandits and they have to fight. You know, there are a lot of options, but not every random encounter needs to be combat.
Right. And again, going back to the urban episode, most of your encounters shouldn't be combat. I get that D&D is very combat heavy. It is designed that way. But if you want to get the most role play out of your role playing game, you need to use the other parts of the character sheet.
Role play in my role playing game? That's preposterous. But yeah, no, these wilderness and these environments do tend to lend themselves very well to the very underutilized skill checks.
All right, so I want to take a minute to talk a little bit about the geography of coastal areas, because I think we need to get a little bit of an understanding of what we're talking about before we can start creating encounters for it.
Okay.
So most coastlines tend to be on either end of a scale that is either imminently traversable or completely impassable.
Fair.
It's almost an inverse bell curve, because you can have these broad floodplains on this river or these very slowly sloping hills leading away from the basin of this lake or leading up from the shoreline with the ocean.
Think deltas and salt marshes for these. I mean, again, if you've not been in coastal areas, these are, again, generally fairly flat. There is a bit of a slope to them, but again, they are flat. There is wide range. There generally a fair amount of wildlife in the area as well, but other than a few divots and pits, you can walk across them pretty easily.
Yeah. Or you end up having stuff on the other end of the spectrum, which is things like the Grand Canyon, which are nearly sheer walls with a river at the bottom of it. And if you need to get from one side to the other side, you have to either get really creative or go around.
Right. And so for these two things, with the sheer wall, the Grand Canyon is a good example. Other ones that I've grown up with is when you kind of hit like the Northern California coast, you get a lot of those sheer rock walls where the ocean kind of beats away at cliff right. sides.
And another example, another famous example would be the Cliffs of Dover.
Absolutely.
Those white chalk cliffs.
Oh, beautiful, yes.
They are. But that is another example of a pretty sheer cliff face abutting the water.
Right. Beyond that, taking your salt marshes and your deltas, you can get something like fens or bogs or bayous where, again, they would be fairly flat, but now you've got a lot of heavy tree growth. You've got these weird pits where it's muddy. It's going, you could walk through some of it, but the part that's, you know, loose dirt soil and then, you know, riverlet or channel where water's flowing through is so intermittent that sometimes traversing these requires special equipment like canoes or boats or mud shoes so you can get across, because you can't just walk straight across because the environment is so broken up.
Right. Yeah. And that is another point that I really want to bring up, is that the traversability of this biome is dependent not only on the shape of the geography, but also the amount of water
yeah.
that is present, because you end up getting areas near bodies of water where it's not terribly permeable, and so the ground is very solid, and then it's basically hard pan. It's easy to walk across. You might end up having an area where it's overgrown with vegetation, but even in that case, especially whenever you're dealing with a freshwater coastal area, if it's freshwater, you're going to end up having game trails, which will make it much easier to traverse that overgrowth.
Yeah. So here's my first hot take of the episode, and you all can shout me down if you want to disagree, but I'm going to say coastal area, be it saltwater coastal, be it freshwater coastal, even in your best case scenario, think your happy beach. How hard is it to run in sand? Sand running is a training method for a lot of various athletes. If you want to deal with freshwater, something like a river where you've got, you know, where the rivers surge and then recede, and so you've got a lot of breakdown of the soil, you've got a lot of loose rocks or mud or other conditions like we talked about. I'm going to say that if you are setting up a scenario in a coastal biome, I'd say 7 out of 10 times, it's going to be difficult to hazardous terrain. There is going to be a movement penalty.
I don't know that I would go quite that far.
Okay.
Because you don't have to walk next to the water.
Fair. But
because, you know, a lot of places where you end up, let's take your beach example. If you walk far enough up the beach to where you start hitting vegetation, then it becomes much more solid and much easier to walk on.
Okay, that is a fair point. At that point, maybe that is a part of the map that you definitely draw out. And so as you get closer to the water, that terrain does become more difficult. And perhaps that becomes a tactical choice for your party, whether they need movement or want to slow the movement of their enemies if they are in fact doing combat. Perhaps they either enter or avoid that area because it is difficult terrain.
Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to your beach, because that is the example that is I'm currently thinking about. Whenever you get down onto the actual open beach where you start hitting that loose sand, where it starts becoming more difficult to walk around, I would say, you know, on that first transitional section, say that first 10 feet of open sand is just difficult terrain for anyone in medium or heavy armor.
Okay.
And then whenever you get past that, when you get into that really loose, chopped up sand, you know, where everyone likes to lay out their beach towels just before you get to the tide line where you start getting water mixed in, where it starts to actually firm up just a tiny little bit. In that section, I would almost make it like the rules for Entangle, I think it is, where it's basically double difficult terrain, where every 1 foot of movement requires 4 feet of movement spent.
Okay.
And have that be the penalty for medium and heavy armor, and then just have light and no armor be just standard difficult terrain. Because even, you know, just walking out there in shorts and a t-shirt when you're going to the beach, it's still hard to walk in.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, that would be something that you could bring in. That would be a dynamic sort of way to implement that. And then once you hit the wet part, you know, switch it back to the same that you had for that first 10 feet, where medium and heavy armor have standard difficult terrain, light armor and no armor are unaffected.
That sounds reasonable to me. And again, that does give your maps a bit of flavor. It's not just, you know, your standard, here's an open grid. You can start kind of putting in some stuff. And like I said, it does make your players think a bit more tactically, which can be a lot of fun.
And then you can throw in things like the native fauna.
Absolutely. So
things like, if you have a giant crab, well, this giant crab has evolved over millions of years to move around in this terrain. It's completely unaffected by the difficult terrain.
Yeah. I could see all the players, but I can't move through it. Well, you didn't live here your entire life.
Yeah. Well, you aren't a crab.
No, I'm just crabby. I love it.
You need to finalize your evolution and become crab.
This isn't my final form.
But going back to freshwater, going back to rivers, whenever you have a river that has a fairly wide floodplain, yeah, it might be kind of muddy and mucky and nasty in that first, you know, 10, 15 feet from the waterline out. But beyond that, it's normal ground.
Yeah.
And as long as it hasn't recently flooded, it shouldn't be sodden, typically. I mean, you can have various terrain features. You can have swamps and marshes that are running parallel to a river. That is absolutely something that happens in real life. But the flatness and relative solidity of river floodplains is the reason why so many major roads follow the course of rivers.
Yes, but
because they don't have to move a lot of dirt to flatten it out to build a road there.
But I will argue, while next to those rivers, while the ground may not be sodden or murky or muddy, where it starts solidifying, you do get so much dense plant growth and undergrowth. You get what's known as riparian growth feature. It's almost a biome within itself, but you do get a lot of thick shrubs and smaller plants that grow in very densely together. So unless there was a path cut out, I could see these by themselves being a hindrance to movement.
Right. And that's why I was bringing up earlier, this would be a great place for a ranger to shine.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they would be able to find those game trails through that dense vegetation to keep it from slowing you down.
Absolutely. And again, we've talked about this with some of our previous guests a handful of times, but the fact that D&D, at least in 5th edition, has kind of really fallen back on that exploration pillar of the role-playing game. And again, what you do out in the wild, what are these random encounters? It's what you do getting between point A and point B. How do you even find where point B is? This is really where the ranger was developed to kind of lead the party through all of this. And with 5e largely removing this aspect of the game, it's one of the reasons why the ranger tends to fall flat in this edition.
Right. And, you know, I find it very interesting because the rogue has a very similar job to the ranger in an urban setting or in a dungeon setting, but they're still able to shine because of the way the game is structured.
Yeah. And again, it's where it falls so heavily on that combat. And there are a handful of things that I wish Wizards would have done different in 5th edition, and hopefully they'll correct with the next edition, particularly the way the Ranger's companions work.
Yeah.
And the way you can kind of see how they're working with familiar, where like familiars and other creatures start moving exactly the initiative after the Ranger's turn, but still has its own turn. I think they probably will wind up correcting that.
Right, because it makes it very difficult to actually utilize your pet.
Yeah.
But we're getting on a tangent again. So
let's, never.
Let's reel that back in just a hair.
All right.
And, you know, one of the other benefits of going through that dense vegetation, you know, having the ranger lead them through that is it makes it very difficult for other people outside of that vegetation to notice you going through.
Oh, that is a great, great idea. So if you're,
it is a great way to move unseen, especially in small groups.
Move unseen. But if you have a ranger in your party and you need to escape, your party is escaping someone or something for some reason, then yes, absolutely. Getting out into the wilds, using this dense, heavy growth to pass unseen and virtually disappear is a wonderful idea.
Yeah, this is where rangers learning Pass Without Trace really comes in handy.
Yeah.
Because they're able to lead you on these game trails through this dense vegetation while you have bonuses to not being seen. So it makes it much easier for you to pass through potentially hostile territory. Or, you know, if you're walking along and you want to avoid the notice of the boatmen going up and down the river, you know, this is a way to do that. If there's a highway, another 50 yards on the other side of the river from you, and there's patrols of soldiers going up and down that you don't want to see you, going through this vegetation is a great way to do that.
That would be great. Just kind of like a quick scenario for like a, here's a something for your party to do. You have like the river barges that transport goods back and forth, or something like the gondoliers in Venice. Maybe there is a person or a packet of information or a MacGuffin of whatever it is that your party needs to acquire by some means. And perhaps you've tried diplomacy at one point and diplomacy has failed. Laying an ambush along one of these rivers in this high dense growth to try to ambush one of these passing barges or boats as they come past would actually be a fairly sound and solid idea to do.
And it is an idea that has historical precedent.
Absolutely.
You know, it is a thing that was done a lot, especially, you know, in America, with the westward expansion, there were lots of instances where native tribes would ambush settler boats and vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that anywhere that you can get an advantage by you having cover and your enemy not having cover, I can guarantee you that there is historical precedent for people using that tactic.
Absolutely.
Because people like being able to shoot at other people without getting shot back.
This is generally an ideal situation, yes.
I mean, a truly ideal situation would be no one shooting anybody, but we don't live in an ideal world, so.
Fair, fair. If I have to shoot, I prefer not to be shot at while I'm doing my shooting.
That is very true.
Putting that out there.
And one more tiny point that I want to make before we move on from this is, with this vegetation being dense, it also screens you from above.
Yes.
So if, because we are dealing with a fantasy setting where we have creatures that are both intelligent and flying, you know, say you're trying to sneak up on the lair of a black or green dragon, going through the vegetation like this would make it much easier for you to get into their domain without them noticing.
I'm just going to walk right down the middle of the road with a giant banner saying, hey, look, I'm a murder hobo. And they're not going to notice.
Yeah.
Go ahead and roll that perception check, DM. I'm good for it.
Yeah. Why is that bird getting bigger?
Yeah.
And bigger. And bigger. And oh God, that's acid. Okay.
Why can't I see the sun anymore? So yeah, again, we've got some freshwater scenarios we can build up. We've definitely got some saltwater things. Another big thing with these areas too is depending on how long your party's been on the road, these coastal areas, these areas where there's going to be a body of water nearby, as we mentioned, are a great place to find food. Start rolling those nature checks to, you know, refill your water skins, refill your ration supplies, if you are monitoring that for your party. If you have an herbalist, an alchemist, a poisoner, a healer within your party, this is another great time for them to be able to look for the supplies they need and use that healer's kit, use that alchemist kit during their downtime when you're camped at night with these wonderful things that you've found if they've made a successful roll.
Right, yeah. This again plays into why you should have a ranger in your party, because in their base package of things that they get at first level, whenever they're traveling through their favorite terrain, they automatically find enough food on their daily travels to feed five people.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to have. I enjoy food.
So there is no survival check required. They just do it.
They just find it. Hey, look, food. But for a random encounter, I think this actually could be a really fun idea, is that depending on what's going on, if you have everyone roll a nature check, perhaps you come across some form of rare plant, whether this is a medicinal rare plant or a dangerous rare plant, up to DM's choice or die rolls perhaps. But again, many times, you know, maybe you come across like a white truffle. Maybe you come across some aloe plants that will heal, you know, if your party's been burned. Maybe you come across something terribly nauseous and poisonous for the, you know, your party wants to avoid, or perhaps something that's a part of a magical or alchemical component that your party can harvest. I mean, hey, you come across these rare blue flowers, they have the scent, you sit there, you roll intelligence or nature check, you find out that this is used in specific potions and that any alchemist in the town would be willing to pay you 50 gold for a pouch of these things. Great.
You come across all of these plants that have these fun little juicy looking yellow and white berries on them. And if you roll low, yeah, they look like they're completely edible. If you roll high, you realize that they're strychnine and they'll kill you.
Yeah, or they make you see all the colors.
And then you die.
Yes. Every mushroom's edible, some just only once.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the ecology now, because we have gotten into that a little bit. Because coastal areas, coastlines are areas where you have everything that life wants. You have reliable source of food, reliable source of water, and quite often you can fabricate a shelter of some sort from the things that are growing around the water. You end up having a plethora of creatures that are going to want to live here. Especially in a freshwater area, you're going to have large mammals. So you're going to have both your herbivores, like your deer and your elk and your moose, but you're also going to have your omnivores like your bears and your carnivores like your wolves. They're going to all come down. It's like the images of the watering holes in Africa. Everything comes to the watering hole because that's where the water is.
So last summer I was really lucky and I got to work at a fossil dig site. And this was how the whole site became formed, is there was a sinkhole that formed, which became like a 9-acre lake where everything just came to drink water. And so they had just a completely wonderful cross-section of the biome at the time. And then, you know, as time, so there were mastodons, there were tapirs, which are like these weird, like elephant pig things. There were birds, there were bear, there were badgers. So at the site I worked with, there was actually red panda. But everything came to this watering hole because there was water and there was food. And so everything came to this one spot. And so, yeah. Almost any kind of animal, especially for your mammals, will be found near one of these zones.
And so most of these creatures are not going to be openly hostile to the players if they come across them. Most of them are going to either be herbivores, so they're not going to be aggressive. Their first instinct is going to be to run away. Or they're going to be carnivores who they're able to rationalize, okay, there's one of me and five of them. I'm not going to tangle with that because that power of self-preservation is very strong, even in, you know, simple-minded animals.
Right. But on occasion, you might come across the very territorial critter who says, this is my lake. Go away.
Yeah. You might come across that 1,300-pound grizzly bear who is just really peeved by the fact that you interrupted his salmon break.
Honestly, that gets underrated a lot, but wild boar
can
be notoriously foul-tempered, and they will wreck your day if you mess with them.
And they, I don't think people realize how big a packs that they run in.
Yeah, they run in like 5 to 10 generally, or larger.
Usually larger, yeah. Because a litter of piglets is usually somewhere in the range of 8 to 10.
Yeah.
And so if you have one boar and three sows, and all three of those sows have babies, you're going to have, you know, 30, 35, 40 pigs in this one group.
I'm not saying this totally wouldn't happen in a party. I'm not saying in real life I probably would be this person. but you're walking through, you come across, and you see the cute little baby bear. And I'm going to pet that dog.
Oh, no.
And I'm going to pet that dog. I'm going to go up, and I'm going to boop its snoot, and I'm going to play with it. And he wants to be my friend. He said, he told me he has telepathy, and he wants to be my friend.
He said it with his eyes.
Mama Bear did not hear that.
Mama Bear disagreed. She disagreed fiercely.
And again, so even if you are a DM or your party does want to lean more heavily into that combat aspect of things, you don't have to have an aggressive creature to provoke player choice. Player choice is absolutely a thing. Let them use those real life wisdom rules.
And, you know, we've had a few creatures that we've made here on the show with guests. I mean, I think the River Crust that we made with Declan from D8 Dungeon,
mm-hmm.
and also the Croconymph that we made with Christian from My Sound Delve. Both of those are aquatic creatures that would really thrive in this sort of environment.
Oh, absolutely. The
River Crust more so in a lake or a saltwater setting, I think, more than a river. They just strike me as being a creature that wants access to deeper water than you get with most rivers.
Fair.
But the Croconymph, absolutely. They would be in that first, you know, 10 to 20 feet of water. And, you know, whenever a river is only 35 feet wide, that's the whole river.
That's my river.
Yeah. And so those are some things that you can really pull in. The Croconymph especially, that would be a great hazard to your party. But expanding out a little bit, whenever we start getting into some of the swampier, marshier areas, when we start getting into some estuary areas where we have that mixture of fresh and salt water, so your bayous and such, that's when your creature demographics start to really shift away from mammals and more into insects, amphibians, and reptiles. Creatures that are going to be spending more time in the water, or, you know, need less time out of the water, I guess, is where I'm getting at.
And while these creatures, again, can be timid, these typically are going to be portrayed as more ambush predators.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that one, if you see them, your party's probably safer, but if they all fail those perception checks, it's time to grab some dice.
Yeah, like that one time that my monk missed the perception check on the crocodile, and the crocodile yes. nearly one-shot him.
Yeah.
And then my kobold monk did one-shot the alligator in return.
Yes, but your kobold monk was also carrying like a three-day-old hunch of meat, and so...
It was half a dead rat.
He was ringing a dinner bell.
He had it coming, let's be honest. I'm not saying that you were not justified in targeting my character. I'm just stating an example.
Yes.
Anyway, this is also going to be a location where you can start pulling in your more amphibious and reptilian humanoid races. This is where your bullywugs and your lizard folk are going to be.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because they don't typically meld well with the other humanoid races in most settings. Not saying that you can't completely integrate them, but this is where they want to be. This is where they belong.
This is their natural habitat. This is, Another would be your Yonti as well would thrive in these kind of regions.
Yeah, especially, you know, given the frequent association with poison and sickness and such that you get with a swamp, because you have all of these creatures and things that are, you know, passing diseases, or, you know, there's stuff that grows in this lukewarm water that just incubates all the time. And so it's very easy to pick up illnesses and infections and such in these locations. So having the Yonti with their natural poison affinity in this location makes sense.
And with these swamps as well, again, we start brushing a little bit up with those urban settings that we've already discussed, but not near so dense. And so with this, again, you're likely to find like maybe the remnants or the beginnings of some sort of dragon cult or like a hag's coven along these lines, where it's not large enough to be a town or a village, but there is a collection of sapient or intelligent creatures forming a very, very, very small community or cluster that would not quite fall into an urban classification.
Right. And if you look into the bayous, especially in Louisiana, you do see this with the, and I hesitate to use this term because I don't know if it is derogatory or not, but the swamp folk, the people who live, you know, fairly isolated lives out in the swamp, a lot of them are living in small single family units, but they're up on stilts.
Yeah.
And you don't have big cities of these people. You have individuals that just sort of plop down wherever it's convenient to plop down.
Very similar to like the old concept of like the Highland clans in like Scotland, or even here in Appalachia, where you have the people that just kind of clustered in the hollers and the small like little valleys in the mountains, because that's where people could kind of eke out a little spot for them to go. And they do form these little clusters of civilization or culture.
And the reason why there are not larger settlements, larger cities in these areas is similar for different reasons. It's because you don't have the large areas of usable land to build a city in. You know, in the swamp, you don't have large areas of dry, solid ground that you can build a city in without taking a lot of time and effort to drain the swamp and, you know, get all the water out and let the soil settle down. And then you have something more solid to build off of. In Appalachia, it's a little bit different because it's just mountains. So you have mountaintops, which don't have any flat ground. You have valley bottoms, which might have a little bit of flat ground, but you just don't have the square footage that you would have in, say, Kansas City, where it's all fairly flat because that's, you know, river delta, you know, or, you know, just the plains next to the river. That's right. It's a similar reason, but for different criteria.
And also kind of talking about that inverse bell curve, this is the other side of that inverse bell curve, where we talked about coastal regions tend to be these hubs of transport, trade, and movement. The smaller regions tend to be more isolated because, for whatever reason, be it terrain, be it the way the water flows, be it the wildlife, again, terrain and movement is severely hindered. And so you can't just get a wagon load of supplies in. They have to be hiked in or boated in or carted or brought in through sledge or a canoe.
And then as we continue on and we get out of this estuary area, out of this mixing of fresh and salt water and get into salt water proper, then you end up having more creatures that are, most of the creatures that you're going to end up having are going to be based from the water.
Yeah.
These are going to be primarily sea creatures.
Or the air.
Yeah, there's going to be lots of birds. But you don't really run into quite as many terrestrial creatures. And the ones that you run into tend to be smaller.
Because they tend to burrow.
They do. It's softer ground, so it's easier to burrow into.
But having an encounter with a burrowing enemy, again, can be kind of exciting because they can quickly disappear. You don't know where they're going to pop up. Their movement speed is different, and it can definitely keep your player on their toes because burrowing critters don't get used too terribly often.
Right. And, you know, the two that would fit really well in my mind talking about burrowing creatures, and referring back to my earlier comment, you know, talking about crabs, Ankegs and Umber Hulks.
Oh, yeah.
Because they both have that insectoid feel. They both burrow. They're primarily found in mountainous areas. But what if you had a variant subspecies of these creatures that lived on a coastline and burrowed through the sands on this beach?
I like this. This also kind of makes me want to modify some of our formians that we've brought up in the past.
Oh, yeah.
I could definitely see some coastal formians from the insect, from the burrowing side, from the seaside. Again, you're going to have your arthropods, like your crabs and things like that. But you might get some of your cephalopods, too, that might be able to breach. And, you know, it's always exciting when a tentacle grabs up and wraps up a character and says, surprise, I got you.
Yeah. And now, my brain is going because, you know, traditionally Formians have a lawful good alignment. Another race that up until their whole, you know, races don't have uniform alignments decision, which was a good decision. Don't get me wrong. My mocking tone is not for that. another lawful good aquatic race would be Tritons.
Yes.
And I could see basically an alliance dual species city where the Formians have burrowed and created a hive city in the sandy portion on the coastline, and where that city touches the water, that's where the Tritons take over, and they have built this giant spherical underwater city.
Ooh, I like it. And now I'm thinking, you know, that the old meme that shrimp is bugs. And yes. So what if these are like shrimp-like or decapod Formians?
They're lobsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
They're lobster Formians. Oh. Yeah.
Yes, I love it. Shrimps is bugs. Shrimps is bugs.
And now we can say that the Chul are these aquatic Formians that have been corrupted by the Far Realms.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yes.
All right. We have gone way off the rails, but I like what we're doing.
Yeah.
But we need to reel it back in for just a minute.
Because again, the whole point of this is to come up with ideas for random encounters. And I promise we're getting there. But we do need to lay out the scenery because we need to know what kind of things to expect when we start kind of rolling this dice saying, yeah, here's a random encounter. Because we're in a coastal area, it's going to make zero sense to say, and you come across a land shark. And I mean, if you want to just like grab a monster out of the bag and throw it on the table, sometimes that is fun and it's random enough to throw everyone off guard, and time and place for that kind of game. And if that's the game you're running, then awesome. I hope everyone enjoys it because that can be a fun way to do things. But if you are keeping things themed to the environs that your players are in, I think we've kind of discussed the vegetation, the flora, the fauna, what kind of people are going to be around, how the biome, like how the land is going to react if it's easily traversed. So I think we can start putting together a table for some dice roll.
I do want to take just a brief moment to point out that we could absolutely have a bolette living on a coastal area. Because what we do is we just reflavor it to be sort of salamander-esque.
Ooh. Okay.
So we make it amphibious.
Fair. Fair. Very fair. Okay. You know what? You said salamander. I'm sold. Fair. Okay.
Okay. Let's get into our random table because we're starting to run a little long. Okay. So D12 table, just standard where we're building out. A one is going to be your combat encounter. The same way that we did with our urban setting. A one is going to be a combat encounter. The nature of that combat encounter is up to you. One thing that hasn't come up yet that is very prominent in these coastal settings, pirates.
Yarr.
Your prime real estate for pirate encounters in this sort of thing. So go ahead, have fun with your pirate encounters.
Yeah, I mean, whether they have, you know, a pirate's cove, whether it's a smuggling point, you know, where they're trying to offload goods, not at an official, you know, taxing port, whether they just have a small point where they've taken shore leave for the time, or maybe there is something of some port that they need here. I don't think a pirate encounter always needs to be combat.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you can absolutely talk your way out of one of these encounters. I'm not suggesting that by making it a combat encounter, somebody rolls a one on their D12 and you're like, oh, well, you better go and roll initiative. No, we don't have to do that.
Fair.
What you're doing is you're creating an encounter that without careful navigation, it is going to become a combat encounter. This is something that if you don't play your cards exactly right, somebody is going to get attacked.
Yes. And that is what I love about the random encounters that we are building is a lot of them do depend on how your players interact. This said, I would almost make the quote-unquote pirate encounter its own category because it can branch off in so many different directions.
Right. And this was also where last time I mentioned getting that random adjective generator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, you roll a one, you decide, okay, we're going to have a pirate encounter, you know, generate some random adjectives, and the adjectives that come up might have nothing to do with actually fighting anybody. And then you get to use your creativity and figure out, okay, how am I going to have this be, you know, clever and jovial?
Yeah, you know, maybe they're there.
That's when you stumble onto a community theater production of the Pirates of Penzance.
Yes, exactly. Maybe you come across, you know, Jackalus, not Sparrow, and he has found his rum stash. Perhaps you get a encounter of pirates and they are looking for a landmark where there is a treasure buried. And now you've got to use your nature and survival checks to help them find this landmark for a cut of their treasure. Perhaps they are trying to get directions to, again, a port city. Perhaps maybe their navigator has fallen ill or has died at sea, and they're looking for someone to tell them how to get to the next port. You can do a lot of different things. And like I said, pirates can go so many different directions. Like I said, I almost want to make the pirate encounter its own random encounter.
Yeah, you probably could do that. You know, just when if you get a combat encounter, you roll a d6 to determine what kind of random encounter. And if it's a pirate encounter, then you get to just do whatever with it. And, you know, you could have things like land animal, sea animal, you know,
Dagrons.
Dragons, yeah, harpies, you know, or just aerial foes.
Yeah.
You know, just have something just generic like that that you can really build off of. All right, so there's one.
One down, 11 to go.
One down, 11 to go. So I think that the bulk of the encounters that you're going to have whenever you're doing a coastal navigation, a coastal exploration sort of thing, is going to be obstacle related.
Absolutely.
You're going to be talking about more terrain-based encounters. You're going to talk about obstructions. You're going down river, you were following the coastline, and there just happens to be another river that enters into the river you've been following, and you've gotten to it, and now you have to get across that river to keep going.
Yeah, so how do you plan to go? Are you going to try to ford the river, or are you going to try to see if you can, like, throw a line over and go across? Are you going to see if there's a ferry nearby? Or are you going to try to fell some trees and perhaps build a bridge? Or are you going to swim against the current? And again, this leads to a lot of role play and a lot of possibilities with your party. You can really use those athletic checks or your strength checks or your dexterity saves. A lot can come up with just that. Other environmental hazards I would see, again, talking about, you know, freshwater, slick rocks, you know, as you're walking and you lose your footing because now the rocks are moss covered. And if you've ever fallen on a bed of rocks, particularly like in a river or stream, it's not comfortable. I could easily see that being 1d4, 1d6 damage because you fall on your back and you smack your head. Now you're concussed. Congratulations.
You know, you turn your ankle and now your movement speed is reduced by 5 feet.
Yeah, exactly. You can throw in a lot of these things. If you're on something like a sandy beach, then yeah, turning your ankle would be very common. Something like a sinkhole or like quicksand that your party. And now you have an adventure that the first two people in your party have stepped in and suddenly they're up to their waist before you realize it's quicksand. How are you reacting? What's the rest of your party going to do? How are you going to rescue your people?
Yeah, every one of us that grew up in the 80s and 90s needs to put quicksand in our games because quicksand was far more dangerous than we were led to believe.
Absolutely.
Far less dangerous than we were led to believe. far less common, too.
Yes. If you're walking along a cliffside and the cliff sides corrode and break down, again, your reaction check, your dexterity, your acrobatics, can you jump back to solid land? Can you tuck and roll? Are you able to grab the edge of a cliffside, or do you fall 50 feet down and into the water below?
Or, you know, you're following along the underside of this cliffside and there's been this 5 foot wide rocky strip of ground as you've been walking along and you've walked 3 miles and now all of a sudden that strip of land has disappeared for the next foreseeable future.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's just the water lapping directly against the cliff face. How are you going to continue? Are you going to turn around and walk 3 miles back so that you can find another way up onto the cliffs and go that way? Are you going to try and forge ahead and hope that you can make it until you get another strip of coastline again? You know, how are you going to solve this problem?
This is one of those really good time to use those underutilized things in your explorer's packs, like, you know, that 50 feet of rope or those pitons that you can use to insert into a rock face to kind of scale across. Great uses of these things. Another thing is if you're on the coast and you are hugging the cliff wall to keep, you know, your back to a wall where you're safe, perhaps there's just a rock slide. Or again, if you're back in freshwater area, perhaps having, again, a perception check to see if you hear the sound of a tree creaking before it falls on your party.
Right. So I would say probably because I want this to be the bulk of stuff, maybe these obstacle encounters would account for half potentially of the encounters that you would come across whenever you're going on coastal. So that would be from 2 to 7.
2 to 7? Okay, yeah. And again, you can fill that out, and depending on if you're on coastal or freshwater, you can use these ideas and kind of build that secondary table of these are the types of environmental hazards. Maybe your party just gets stuck in the mud and they lose so much time. That was a great mechanic within Tomb of Annihilation, was how fast your party was traveling, how much ground they covered, if they were burning through their rations faster or not. You can do the same thing with the terrain. If the terrain slows your party down, if they've got a deadline they've got to be somewhere by, or if they only have so much in the way of provisions, this is something your party will have to adapt to.
Right, yeah. This is also a thing where having a guide or having a ranger that is capable in this particular type of terrain is really going to help you a lot.
Yes.
In case you haven't noticed, we're trying to finagle people into playing a ranger because not enough people do, and not enough people... Well, it's because, as we have mentioned before, the ranger doesn't get to shine very often, and so... You know, by highlighting these particular elements of gameplay where a ranger could shine, it really emphasizes how to adapt a game in such a way as to play to the strengths of a particular character class.
Right. And this will engage the ranger a lot more frequently. I do know a lot of newer players to D&D do like to play the ranger because they do want the pet and they do want that companion. And a lot of them do get disappointed because there is so little for the ranger to do. This, again, pulls them back into the game and does create involvement.
Right. Okay, let's continue on. So we've got 8 through 12. We've got 5 entries left to do. So
I think finding some ruins
could
be a solid encounter, be it finding an old hut, maybe ancient ruins of some sort that your party can explore, even a small map in itself, which could be, you know, either, hey, here's a single one room shack, or perhaps it is a small, you know, 5 or 6 room, quote, quote, dungeon for your players to explore that might or might not have combat within it. But think of like the caves in Skyrim, something like that, where your players, here's an encounter, there's something inside, there's probably treasure or at least something semi-valuable inside. Let's go exploring.
So let's put that down as 8 and 9.
Okay.
8 would be something that is a permanent feature. So things like, you know, the ruins of a building or a cave that you can explore or something of that nature, something that is a geographical landmark that can be referenced and returned to later. Okay. Whereas 9 would be an ephemeral ruin. So something like a shipwreck. Something like detritus from a storm, you know, things that have washed up on the shore, things that are at risk of being pulled back out to sea the next time there's a big storm.
An old camp that someone broke down in a hurry.
Yes. Or an old camp that nobody broke down because they were attacked by animals in the night.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, it's not permanent, but again, a great thing to kind of stumble across. That's great.
Yeah. So let's see here. So 10, I think, would be an encounter with a simple creature, if that makes sense. A creature that does not have that high intellect.
Okay.
So like your beasts and monstrosities, your things with the low intelligence scores that are they're not sentient.
Okay, that's fair. And again, whether or not you're coming across them or they're hungry or they're just kind of blocking your path and how you choose to deal with that, that does lead to a fair amount of role play and how your characters are playing their characters. Whether you want to give that baby bear a huge hug because it's just the damned cutest thing you've ever seen, or perhaps maybe you get to the watering hole, your canteens are empty, and there's a herd of hog and they are blocking the path to the water. What are you going to do?
Yeah, or, you know, you haven't had a good solid meal for the last 4 days. You've been living off of good berries for the last 4 days, and you really just want something that is not a berry. And you come across and you find like a herd of 4 or 5 deer.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if somebody is able to drop one of these deer, that's good eating.
That is good eating. I agree.
Yeah. That would be another thing that you could get in that sort of thing. But you're also talking about sea creatures that are going to have that low intelligence score. So maybe giant crabs, maybe some of the aquatic undead that we have brought up in the past. So something like a sea spawn or the drowned. I think the drowned are in the Ghost of Salt Marsh book. Basically, they're drowned sailors that are condemned to undeath because they have some goal that was left unfulfilled. It's usually treasure-based because they're generally considered evil creatures. But yeah, that would be a thing where, you know, you're walking along and all of a sudden these undead humanoids start walking out of the water.
Okay. Again, it could be some sort of predatory or scavenging bird as well. And again, depending on the condition of your party, they could be an annoyance to a problem to, hey, look, there's a pretty bird in the sky. All fair.
Yeah, it could be something as simple and as cute as, you know, a family of otters sitting in the river cracking open oysters. Or it can be something as potentially terrifying as, say, a whale that has washed up on the beach and there are a pack of wyverns or a rock feeding on it.
Yes. And actually, an adventure like that pops up in Candlekeep Mysteries, which is a very fun book as well.
Yeah, the one that we ended up avoiding by just going in the water and going around it.
Yes, that was a very anticlimactic scenario, but still very well handled by the party. I think 10 at this point should be a...
That was 10.
Was that 10? Okay, yeah. Yes. 11 at this point should be a nature check of some sort. Like I mentioned before, maybe you come across a rare plant or animal or something along those lines that, you know, could be a benefit to your party or could be a detriment to them depending on, you know, their intelligence or their nature or survival skills. It could be both. You know, maybe it is a valuable plant if harvested correctly, and if harvested incorrectly is a great danger. And I'm kind of thinking like serving the pufferfish in the Simpsons episode where only like a certain part of it was edible, but it was like a grand delicacy if you could do it correctly. And it was deadly poisonous if you don't. Again, brought up a plant that could be alchemical, or giving your members of party a chance to use like their herbalism kits or their alchemy kits. With this, perhaps you do come across some carnivorous plants as well, something like assassin vines or
shambling mounds.
Or shambling mounds, yeah.
And going back into our poisons episode, all medicinal plants are also poisons. It's just a matter of what dosage you use.
Yes.
So the inverse is not always true.
Yeah.
You know, not all poisonous plants are also medicinal, but all medicinal plants can be poisonous if you medicine them wrong enough.
Right. So a great example of this is the foxglove plant. It's a very pretty flower. It's generally white or purple. They do use elements for the foxglove plants for heart medicine.
Yes.
That said, if you take too much of it, it will also cause a heart attack.
Yes. Because I think, does it relax cardiac muscles? Is that generally what it does?
What it does to the cardiac muscles, I think it stimulates them to a point.
Oh, does it stimulate? Okay.
It might. I'm not 100% certain. It's been forever since I did my toxicology report on foxglove. But yeah, again, as Ian quoted Paracelsus, the poison is in the dosage.
So yes, that would be 11. That brings us to 12. 12 is our beneficial encounter. So this could be you're going upriver and this merchant barge coming downriver sees you and flags you down and warns you of some hazard further up the river that you need to prepare for or find a way to get around it. You know, it could be somebody else going upriver and seeing you and offering to take you on to get you upriver faster.
Hey, you need a ride? Yeah, I'll take a ride. It could be finding a treasure, again, be it on the beach or in the thing, just kind of coming across. Hey, here's a lockbox that someone stashed away, thinking nobody would find it. Maybe you come across a healer. Maybe your party has had a couple really rough days in the wild. You've picked up some diseases or you've been banged up and you haven't had a chance to really use that long rest in those heals. And maybe you come across someone who is adept and able at healing and get your party back up to max HP again.
Yeah. Or, you know, going along more of a saltwater coastal thing, you know, you're walking along the coastline and you see where three or four boats have beached themselves and you have a small settlement in the process of being constructed. And Fair. So you're coming up on these new settlers in this region and you're able to interact with them and have potentially some very beneficial interactions with them. And this could be a great way to have the players start building a rapport with these individuals and giving them a base of operations.
I like it.
You know, giving them a place that they can call home, a place that they can influence the development of.
I like it. Maybe again, we come across another pirate encounter or smuggler encounter. And you know what? They just don't want to pay those taxes. Or perhaps maybe the political situation has shifted suddenly and they are less than welcome at a port they were planning. And so now they've got a shipload of goods that they would rather offload at a reasonable to steep discount rather than making a return trip back home full of goods and empty pockets.
Yeah, at this point, they're looking to break even.
Yeah.
And so they're willing to sell this stuff to you at cost.
Yeah.
Because they need that capital to be able to go back and buy another load of stuff.
Yeah, you can do so much. We need a pirate episode.
We probably do. And whenever we get to like a seafaring, island hopping sort of biome setting episode, we are definitely going to be going heavy into that sort of maritime adventure with piracy and stuff.
Yay, merchant marines.
Yeah. We may have to try and see if Matt or Eric from the Goblin's Corner want to come on because they're always talking about pirate campaigns.
Oh, that'd be so much fun. I love them.
And seeing as they have run far more pirate campaigns than I have, that would be a great perspective to bring
Absolutely.
In. So, Eric, if you're listening to this, reach out to me.
Find a spot in your calendar.
And if I don't hear from you in 2 weeks, I know that you haven't listened to it. And then I'm going to reach out to you and I'm going to mock you for it. No, Ian's I'm not.
Better, not at all.
I'm not. Eric's good people.
He is very good people.
All right. But I mean, I think that's our table.
Yeah, that's our table.
We've got it put together more or less. You know, again, fiddle with it as you see fit. If you're going through an area that you're not planning on having a whole lot of people interacting with the party in this encounter, shrink it down to a D10 and take some of those interpersonal encounters out. If you're going through, say, this is a river that runs through a very arid sort of desert setting, and so you're not going to have as many animals involved in this particular encounter, shrink it down to a D10, take some of those animal encounters out. It's, you know, tinker with it and make it what you need it to be.
Yeah, you can do a lot with this, but I do think it makes that time in between cities when your party's just kind of traveling a lot more interactive, a lot more exciting. Take books like The Hobbit. All of the adventure happened between the cities for the most part. I mean, yeah, there were the things, but all of like the memorable moments were like in the Mirkwood and in the river. And I forget the name of the river, but it was those in-between areas. And like I said, fifth editions kind of fell really flat on that exploration aspect of the game. So I really think bringing some stuff like this back in can be quite exciting.
I mean, if you're looking at the Sam and Frodo storyline, after they leave Rivendell, they don't show up in another city until the very end of the trilogy when the Eagles bring them back to Rivendell.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that short period of time whenever they show up in Osgiliath, but that's more of a ruin than a city, so let's just not even bother.
Fair. But a lot of games in Fortress, like, yeah, you leave the city, you wander through the woods, the DM might roll a couple dice if you're camping for the night, and you're there. And it's like, so much could have happened.
So much. And that's what we're trying to help inspire in our listeners right now, is figuring out how to make exploration more fun, make it more interactive, make it something that doesn't feel like drudgery.
Yes. For the players and the DM.
Yes, both. Absolutely. But I think we have drowned this paladin enough.
Yes.
I think we've run a little bit longer than I was intending, but that's neither here nor there. It is what it is. We have made an episode.
We're going to go back to waterboarding the paladin. That's all I heard.
Yeah. The third paladin burned down, fell over, and then sank into the swamp, but the fourth one stood up. But anyway, thank you everyone for listening to our tangent-riddled episode tonight. If you have any comments, suggestions, or ideas, please send us an email undercommontaste@gmail.com or send us a direct message through our Discord channel. You can find a link to the Discord in our show notes. We would love to have you come over and chat with us. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, for as long as that exists, YouTube and Twitch, along with Blue Sky and Mastodon. You can find us at UnderCommonTaste on all of those platforms. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/UnderCommonTaste. That's where our write-ups go. These past couple of weeks have been absolutely exploding in my face, so I don't have the poison crafting write-up done yet. I'm still working on layout. It will be up soon. I need to stop stating that I'm going to have things done in a set timeline because that always never happens. but I'm also working on the more expanded patron-only version. We are on Itch, undercommontaste.itch.io. That's where you can find our liminal horror adventure Beneath the Lake and my solo RPG Forever Home. At this point, the Solo But Not Alone 4 bundle has wrapped up. They did hit their funding goal. It was a great time. Thank you for everyone who bought that and who downloaded my game. I hope that lots of people played it. Even if they didn't leave reviews, I hope that lots of people played it. And hopefully they enjoyed it. If you did enjoy it, please go and leave a review and let us know.
If this is your first time listening to us, welcome. We're so glad you found us. You can find our other episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Apple, iHeartRadio, Spotify, iTunes, Google. Again, just wherever podcatcher you use, you can find our other episodes. Just look us up at Under Common Taste. As always, please give us a rating and review. It helps increase our visibility and lets us know what kind of content you want to hear more of.
Stay safe, everyone. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another biome episode, probably. My daughter has actually requested us do a series on dragons. So since she is now old enough to actually listen to the podcast, we're going to, at some point, not in the immediate future, but some point soon, start doing episodes covering the different types of dragons and how you can modify the Monster Manual dragons into different settings and different scenarios.
Very excited.
But anyway, stay safe, everyone, and we will see you all again in 2 weeks.
Happy gaming.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Under Common Taste. Our theme song is Massacre Anne, written and performed by Mary Kroll and used with permission. You can find Mary online at marykroll.bandcamp.com or on Patreon at patreon.com/Dr. Mary C. Kroll. Our logo is by David Sutherland. You can find more of David's work on deviantart.com/David Sutherland or on instagram.com/willx_73. We'll be back in 2 weeks, so stay safe, and we'll see you then.